Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists come to share their most recent work. My name is Kate, and for this week's episode, I had the honor of chatting with Dr. James Gross. James is a professor of psychology here at Stanford, where he directs the Stanford Psychophysiology Lab. His research focuses on emotions, what they are, how they play out over time, and how people can regulate them. James has over 500 publications, which have been cited over 150,000 times. In this week's episode, James will be sharing insights from a recent multinational study of brief emotion regulation interventions. And I hope that you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hi, James. Welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast.
Thanks for the invitation, Kate.
So for today, you shared this incredible paper with us, which is titled A Multi-Country Test of Brief Reappraisal Interventions on Emotions During the COVID-19 Pandemic. This paper was just recently published in Nature Human Behavior, and it is based on the data that were collected on over 20,000 participants across 87 countries. I must admit, I did not actually count all of the co-authors on this paper, but it was something in the ballpark of like 350 or close to 400 researchers, maybe, that it took to actually do this study, which is really extraordinary. And so before we dive into the paper itself, maybe we should unpack the title a little bit, because I think that not everyone may be familiar with the word reappraisal.
Yeah, well, thanks, Kate. So I think that the first thing to say is, of course, that we feel emotions in many different contexts, and often they're helpful, sometimes they're not. And I think our worry was that given all of the difficulties associated with the pandemic, that there'd be an increased level of negative emotions and decreased level of positive emotions, putting people at risk for, not just immediate suffering, but perhaps increased incidence of mental disorders and a sense of isolation. So we and many other people have been concerned about these increased negative emotions, decreased positive emotions. And we wondered, what could we do, leveraging basic science, And so that brings us to, well, what did we do? And to understand reappraisal, we have to take a couple steps back and get a running start here. And this notion of reappraisal comes from really Dick Lazarus and his work in the 1960s. So the term itself is an homage to Dick Lazarus, who is an eminent psychologist, most associated with stress and coping research. But in the later part of his career, very central to the emerging field of emotion and affective science more generally. And on Dick Lazarus's view, and on many people's view, the reason we have emotions in many cases is because we are in a situation that for some reason grabs our attention, and we then think about it in a certain way. And that's the heart of what's called appraisal theory, the idea that if we think about situations in a particular way, that is to say, we appraise them in a particular way, we're then very likely to have certain patterns of changes of experience and behavior and physiology that we know as emotions. So things like anger or sadness or anxiety. So that's a brief account of appraisal theory. And many, many people endorse this view that there's some sort of thinking or cognitive evaluation of a situation that really is the magic sauce that translates just a normal old situation into something that has meaning for us, that creates an emotion. So that gets us to appraisal. And many of us, walk through our lives and have certain ways of thinking about situations, and that generates these emotions. So those are sort of our default appraisals, what we tend to do if nothing sort of pushes us to do something different. So the notion of reappraisal is that these appraisals are actually plastic or malleable, so that either another person or even ourselves can lead, push for a change in appraisal. And the logic then of appraisal theory is if you can change the appraisal, you can actually probably change the emotion as well, given that appraisal is what generates, or an important part of what generates the emotion. So that's reappraisal. Reappraisal is an attempt to try to think differently about some aspect of the situation or about what you're trying to achieve in that situation. And the goal often is to modify the emotion, typically to decrease negative emotions or increase positive emotions. Although there's been some really cool work that suggests that sometimes people have other emotion goals. So sometimes they actually want to increase negative emotion or decrease positive emotion. So that's the sort of short history of reappraisal and why we thought this might be such a promising sort of pressure point for thinking about changing people's emotions during the pandemic.
Wow, thank you for that terrific overview of not just reappraisal, but a summary of history of research and theorizing about emotions. So now that we have that cleared up, let's start with a high-level overview of the paper. Tell us what you did and what are some of the key takeaways?
Yeah, so thanks, Kate. So the first, you know, part of an answer to what we did is sort of defining the we in the what we did. And this is a sort of unusual we, as you've hinted already, because there are literally hundreds of authors on this paper. And that flows from the fact that this is a group effort. Increasingly, I think in science, we are appreciating the value of group efforts. Lots of people and lots of smart ideas come together, particularly when you're trying to push emotions around in potentially helpful ways in the context of a pandemic, and you want to check whether these efforts to intervene are actually helpful, not just in one place, but across many, many different contexts, because that's certainly what we were looking for. So the mechanism for this effort was something called the Psychological Science Accelerator. And that's a group of networked laboratories that work together to try to expand the reach of science, psychological science. And they put out a call for, you know, projects that they thought would be relevant to the pandemic. And so Ki Wang, who is a lead author on this project with Amit Goldenberg, both at Harvard, were the ones who were responsible for putting in, along with Jen Lerner and some other colleagues at Harvard, were responsible for proposing this project to the Psych Science Accelerator. In a, you know, crowded field, they were selected as one of several, a small number of projects to be moved forward. And that resulted in this project. And the way the Psych Science Accelerator works is that these networked labs, once a project has been selected, collaborate. And so anyone who wants to join can join. And in this context, there were 186 laboratories from around the world, 55 countries and regions, 42 languages that made up this team. And they rolled out the protocol that was developed by our team. And they then, you know, busily translated everything and made sure that different people in different groups, you know, got the protocol. And that resulted in, as you said, over 20,000 participants in 87 countries and regions. And it was a really interesting process. I'm happy to say more about it, but I think a very good process. That's the we. So it was really a terrific group of scientists from around the world working collaboratively in the context of a pandemic, trying to do some good. And the particular kind of good here was to try to influence people's emotions to some degree, slightly, hopefully, decreasing negative emotions and increasing positive emotions. In terms of what we did then, this big we of hundreds of people, it was centered on this idea of reappraisal, that we can change people's thinking in order to change their emotions. And we were particularly interested in two theoretically distinct forms of reappraisal. So when we have thoughts about both the situation around us and what we're trying to achieve, our goals in the situation, it's really a comparison of those two things. What we're trying to achieve and how the world is or isn't conducive to what we're trying to achieve, that's what's generating the emotion. So it's that gap between what we want and what is that seems to be the driver. And in, I think, very important theoretical work that was the foundation for this project, and Dara Usberg articulated this distinction and just a few years ago. And this is the distinction between repurposing and reconstrual. So these are two flavors of reappraisal. And so drawing on this theoretical distinction that Andera developed, we asked participants from around the world to view COVID-related pictures. And we asked them, in one condition, to use repurposing, which is one flavor of reappraisal, a flavor that focuses on, gee, what are my goals in this situation? Another group of participants was focused on reconstrual. So that's sort of focused on representing how bad is the situation that I'm seeing in this case in the picture. So given that it's really both sort of how we represent what's going on and how we represent what our goals are, we thought that targeting each of these two different components of the emotion generative appraisal process might be promising in terms of moving emotions around. So those are the two reappraisal conditions, theoretically distinct. We had some specific ideas about how they might actually produce slightly different patterns of results. And then we contrasted those two forms of reappraisal to two kinds of controls. One is a more active control that we thought might have a slight positive benefit, which was just reflecting on your thoughts and feelings as you look at this picture. Another was a lower level or passive control, which just had to do with respond as you naturally would. And the basic logic of the design was to randomly assign people to conditions. Obviously, that's the key for experimental investigations in which you want to have causal inference, because if you randomly assign people, particularly at this scale, you're likely to have all of the kind of confounding factors sort of come out in the wash. So we had people randomly assigned to four conditions. And our primary tests were looking at the two reappraisal conditions and contrasting them to the two control conditions. And so that's sort of what we did. And people, you know, were randomly assigned to these conditions and then busily applied the instructions again and again across 10 pictures that they saw, and then said how they felt about the pictures and about sort of COVID in general, and also reported on a few other things as well. But our basic prediction, our core prediction, was that reappraisal compared to the two control conditions would decrease negative emotion and would increase positive emotion. So that was sort of our major focus. And then it's a more minor focus. We wondered about whether the two reappraisal conditions might differ a little bit from each other. So, Kate, that's what we did.
Yes, thank you for this wonderful overview of the paper. So what did you find about the two different flavors of reappraisal? So reconstrual, as you said, and repurposing, were they equally effective at reducing negative emotions and increasing positive emotions?
Yeah, you've got it exactly right, Kate. So despite our initial thought based on theory that there might be some subtle differences, we found that the two types of reappraisal really had fairly similar effects. So the main sort of finding from this project is that using these reappraisal approaches, either one of them, seems to decrease negative emotions and increase positive emotions compared to either both of the control conditions together or each of the control conditions separately. And that there's much less evidence, really very little evidence in our hands, that there's important difference between the two types of reappraisal. We are, I think, holding open the possibility that under other circumstances, there might be some subtle differences between the two forms of regulation or reappraisal. But it certainly, in this case, looking at the short-term effects of these interventions, we did not find evidence for separability.
Right. So that actually makes me think about a more general question about the usefulness of reappraisal under different kinds of circumstances. Because in the early days of the pandemic, the narrative that we're all in this together has really spread across the globe faster than the virus itself did, or at least I felt that way. But of course, it soon became very clear that people around the world were not actually all fighting the same fight. Some people got sick, some people lost their loved ones, and others had none of that, but they also struggled in their own ways that were important and consequential. So with all of that in mind, with all of that complexity and variability in people's experiences, I'm curious how we should think about effectiveness of reappraisal in all of these different kinds of situations. So my two questions are, first, are all of these different kinds of situations that people have been dealing with in the pandemic equally amenable to reappraisal? And two, does reappraisal actually work equally well across negative emotions that are of different flavors and intensities?
Yeah, well, great. Those are super questions. I think let's sneak up on those questions by observing that in these data, we found really quite comparable effects, not just for the two reappraisal conditions versus the control conditions, but also across the different countries and regions that we studied. So in the main and in most contexts, we saw these effects and they were roughly comparable size effects, even though these are very different cultural contexts. And people within each cultural context, as you nicely pointed out, are facing really quite different circumstances, not just with respect to COVID, but certainly with respect to many life domains. So I think one big message here is that reappraisal, at least in a COVID context, does seem to move the dial for many, many different people in many different cultural contexts. There's, as is always the case, variation in how positive or negative people are feeling, and also in how big these effects are for different people, given their starting points. But I think the main take home for me from this study is that reappraisal does seem to really across the board for people in this context decrease negative emotion and increase positive emotion. Now, more generally, I think you're asking a number of good questions about theoretically and in other very different contexts, what would we expect? Are there conditions under which you really can't rethink a situation? And I think what we've learned so far in the broader field of emotion regulation is that there really are some very important limits. So when emotions are at a very high intensity, people tend not to choose to try to reappraise. And we think that's because it's extremely difficult to really rethink effectively situations that are overwhelming and highly intense. There's another kind of question lurking here, which I think it's worth bringing to the fore, which is it even a good idea to always change our emotions? I started with the premise that, during the pandemic, there's just a ton of suffering and dislocation and change to people's lives. And that one of the consequences of that is heightened levels of negative emotion and diminished levels of positive emotion. And that's a bad thing. And I think many people would agree with that, particularly as we learn more about the risks associated with chronically elevated levels of negative emotion or of chronically suppressed levels of positive emotion. But I think that's a generalization and we need to be really careful because I think in some contexts, it really is very important to not fiddle with one's emotions via reappraisal or any other strategy. So there may be emotions that are just incredibly important in motivating us to do things that are consistent with our values. For example, if we feel that society has certain kinds of injustice that we think need to get fixed, and we get really angry about that. We want to get politically engaged. It is true that reappraisal can be used to decrease one's emotions, and people who tend to use reappraisal tend to have lower levels, let's say, of anger in this political context. But very nice work by Brett Ford and her team has shown that even though reappraisal is, quote, effective in the short term, one of the downstream effects of that is lesser political engagement. So that would, I think, mean that if we value political engagement and trying to really make a difference in the world as we confront various kinds of injustice, then it might not be a good idea to apply reappraisal to that kind of anger in that kind of context. So several different answers there. First, these effects seem very general. Second, I think there are cases that have been averaged over in this data set with the thousands and thousands of individuals and the fairly simple picture viewing paradigm that we used. But there are certainly other cases where, confronted with high levels of emotion, we may not be able to reappraise. And then there's the added element that we may not want to reappraise. We may not want to fiddle with our emotions. So, Kate, those are my thoughts about sort of the generalizability of these effects mm-hmm. and the utility of these effects and the sort of desirability of this kind of intervention.
That is super interesting. And I especially want to highlight this point that even though negative emotions may be unpleasant, they also serve important functions, at least sometimes. So especially in the context like the COVID-19 pandemic, negative emotions may not only be normal, but also necessary, because it's possible that negative emotions are actually driving people to wear their masks, to get vaccinated, and to take other steps to help stop the spread of the virus. So my question to you is, and I know that you looked at people's intentions to continue engaging in prevention behaviors as part of the study, but my question to you is more general. How should we think about the potential unintended consequences of an intervention like this?
Yeah, as you said, Kate, one of the things we were worried about is that even though people often say they want to reduce negative emotions and increase positive emotions, we worried about unintended consequences. And the particular flavor of worry that we had and were able to test revolved around health behaviors, as you said. So, you know, one idea about the drivers for these health behaviors, such as wearing masks or washing your hands thoroughly, that you have negative emotions. So your feelings of anxiety, for example, might lead you to be more careful about washing hands and wearing masks. And the worry that flows from that analysis is that if you take away the anxiety or turn it down, maybe you're also inadvertently turning down these health behaviors. So we actually tested that in exploratory analyses. And we had to look at intentions rather than actual behavior because of the design constraints that we faced in running this study at scale across so many different countries. We weren't able, as we would have dearly loved to be able to do, observe actual behavior or have repeated assessments over longer periods of time. We needed to decrease the burden on participants, being sensitive to the fact that precisely because it was during a pandemic, we couldn't have them each take days and days of their time to complete a study for no financial remuneration. So we were somewhat constrained. We focused on intentions, but saw no evidence whatsoever that this intervention shifted people's health behaviors in negative direction. So that's one unintended consequence that we don't think we activated. But I think more generally, we do need to be mindful of, you know, anytime we change a complex system, whether it's a person or a society, there may well be unintended consequences. And to really look at those, you know, clearly as we try to, you know, make the world a better place for people and other living things. And so from my perspective, I guess the way I see this is, you know, there may be conditions under which negative emotions are helpful or positive emotions are overrated or unhelpful. But in the main, giving people a technique or an approach that allows them to exercise greater agency over the emotions that they and loved ones have, I think is a good thing in general. So providing another tool in their toolkit so that they, as they move through their lives or they help their children or other loved ones move through their lives, just having a sense of greater control or agency in their emotional lives, I think is a very powerful force for good. Now, can any tool be used for ill? Sure, give, a chainsaw to a five-year-old and bad things can happen. But I think, providing, emotion regulatory tools that, that can be used responsibly with an eye to, inadvertent or unintended consequences, I think is a step in the right direction. So that's my guiding sort of philosophy. But I'm very mindful that even good intentions can lead us to act in ways that backfire. And so we try to be very vigilant as we do this work and related work to really make sure that we understand, what the range of consequences might be. And sometimes we decide that an intervention really isn't a good idea. But in this case, I think providing this kind of resource for people is a good thing. And we've actually had a number of, folks reach out to us having seen this paper. And in one follow-on project, Health Center on the East Coast is very interested in applying this kind of approach to lessening negative emotion and enhancing positive emotion in healthcare workers. And you could imagine, because it's so easy to scale this kind of intervention and apply it in particular contexts, that that would really be a lot of opportunity for helping people. So that's sort of my take on the pros and cons of this sort of intervention. But I think your point's well taken. Anytime you change a complex system, got to look carefully at what actually happens, not just what you think might happen.
Yeah, James, thank you for this really thoughtful response, because I completely agree that as scientists, especially, we all share a responsibility to think about unintended consequences, no matter how noble our intentions are. So something else I'm wondering about is that here in this study, you ran an intervention that was brief, relatively cheap, and fully remote also, I should say, fully virtual. And clearly it was highly successful, at least in the short term. But I don't know if you'd be willing to speculate a little bit about how lasting you think those reappraisal skills are that people developed as part of your intervention. And how much do you think those skills actually generalize to other non-COVID related contexts?
Yeah, well, Kate, thanks for asking. I think we have evidence from within this study that the largest effects are the things that are closest to the intervention. So we see pretty big effects or shifts in negative and positive reactions to the pictures themselves. We see some effects, but smaller effects as we move further and further away within the session to more distal affective outcomes. For example, anticipated negative and positive emotions as they looked forward to the future. So I think there's a gradient of effect sizes here. I think there are a couple of key questions that you're pointing to. One is, for these people who had this intervention, if we were able to peer into their lives a week, a day, a month, a year later, how durable are these effects? Would we be able to detect differences as a function of what condition they were in? I like to think that we might see differences, certainly on the a few weeks later to a month later kind of time scale. But I'd be surprised, given the complexity of life and the many, many other factors that are operative, whether a single intervention, very brief intervention that's picture-based and highly constrained, whether that would be significant enough of an intervention to create durable change that would last for years. I think that'd be very surprising. Very few interventions, if any, have that effect, certainly not in this domain. But I do wonder, this brings us to the question of sort of whether there are other kinds of benefits. Maybe they don't feel far less negative emotions and far more positive emotions on an everyday basis. But I do wonder whether, for the people assigned to reappraisal, whether that sort of experience of seeing their own emotions change a little bit might have built their efficacy or their sense of sort of ability to change emotions. And one of the things we do know is that people's beliefs about what emotions are and whether they can be changed, powerfully predict whether they actually use effective emotion regulation strategies like reappraisal. So one of the hopes I guess I have is that even though they might not feel generically more positive and generically more negative, that even this one experience of success might have shifted slightly their belief that emotions can be changed under some circumstances, and maybe even a belief that they are able themselves to affect that change. And if that were true, that might provide a mechanism, not for changing their global emotions, but perhaps their emotions at key moments when they actually have the chance to use reappraisal. They might be slightly more likely to do that. And if they did increase the use of reappraisal, that might have a sort of building on itself effect, so that they then might be on a slightly different track in life, trying out different forms of regulation, perhaps enjoying increased success, and thereby increasing the use of reappraisal. So don't think these will be infinitely durable, certainly with this level of intervention. But I do wonder whether there are some impacts that are more targeted around people's beliefs and their use of reappraisal. And one of the things I'm very interested in, of course, is trying to figure out how big a dose of reappraisal training or any other form of emotion regulation training do you really need to give in different, you know, contexts to really be able to have durable, clinically significant impacts. Right now, that's an open question, but those are my initial thoughts.
That is so interesting. You know, it is absolutely right that people oftentimes think of emotions as something that happens to them rather than something that they have control over. And this also makes me think about something that you were saying earlier in our conversation today, which is that emotions arise as a result of the interpretations that people make of the situations that they find themselves in. So there is this really intimate connection between emotions and thoughts, but it runs contrary to another belief that people often have, which is that emotions and thoughts are different. And so I'm just curious, where do these beliefs come from and how can we target them more directly? And should we even target them more directly, right? So I'm sorry, I'm throwing a lot of questions at you, but you can just sense my excitement here.
Yeah, well, thanks, Kate. So I do think most of us aren't given very deep or extensive instruction in what emotions are and more generally sort of how our minds work. So I think we pick up what we can. There's typically very little formal instruction, although increasingly people are interested in socio-emotional learning curricula, much of which, unfortunately, is not always scientifically grounded. So I think even when people do get instruction, it can be a bit of a mishmash of empirically supported, non-empirically supported ideas. But I think the modal case, probably, certainly in our culture and around the world, is to have very little formal instruction. And even informal instruction from coaches and parents and caregivers, you know, it can be somewhat hit or miss. So I think probably most of us have come to these problems with a fairly limited set of understandings around what are emotions and what is thinking and how does my mind even work anyway. So I think we try to work it out as best we can. It's terribly important. We're, of course, a highly social species. We spend a lot of time thinking about motives and what people are likely to do and what we're likely to do and how we can change things in these domains. So I think we're doing the best we can, but I don't think we're, you know, given a lot of instruction. So it makes sense to me that there is this very broad distinction that recurs again and again between the sort of cool representation or set of processes that support representation of things that are just sort of there in the world. But these are not things necessarily that immediately concern us. And that broadly we refer to that set of processes about things that don't immediately concern us. We refer to as thinking. another kind of representation and set of processes has to do with the world and our state inside ourselves. But this is under conditions where we actually care about what's going on. It has immediate relevance. And here would say, well, that those are affective representations and processes. So you sort of have thinking or colder cognition, and then affective or emotional or hotter processing. Now, from my point of view, these are all, you know, related to one another intimately. But I think that first pass distinction between just sort of thinking, quote, thinking, and quote, having emotions, is rooted in this very important distinction between representations that don't have immediate relevance. I mean, they're relevant enough to notice, but they're not particularly relevant to our goals in the moment. And then the subset of these processes that seem to have actual immediate relevance. And what's confusing here is that you can think of everything that happens in our mind that has to do with representations as thinking. So thinking would be the superordinate category. And then, you know, the subset of that would be emotional or affective, just those thinking instances that really about things we care about. So that's one idea, thinking at the top and emotional versus non-emotional or affective versus non-affective representations within that thinking category. But I think the simpler view is just kind of two buckets. There's the cold stuff, that's thinking, and there's the hot stuff, that's emotion. And I think that has some utility, so people make that distinction. But I think, as is always the case, when one double clicks or learns more about a domain, you sort of see those cartoon initial distinctions that have some serviceability. They break down and they need to be refashioned and made more precise. So that's, I think, what we're doing as we think about emotion regulation and learning more about emotion. We see that emotions are centrally about representations of the world as it is, representations of the world as it would like it to be, how those two kinds of representations relate to one another. And we think that's what really generates emotion. And that's a somewhat more sophisticated view of the ways in which these representations, cold and hot, sort of come together to support both cold thinking and hot emotion. And that's relevant here because it really is crucial to use our thinking to change our emotions. And that insight's not a new one. It goes back thousands of years, of course, in the Western tradition and in other traditions. But I think what's new in the past couple decades is really the empirical science that's been applied, the scientific method that's been applied to really pulling these things apart and carefully testing them and quantifying effects that hasn't been done in prior centuries. So that's, I think, how we end up in a world where people, to the extent they think about emotions at all, have these somewhat confused ideas about the role of thinking. And I think subjectively, this is supported, this notion of a distinction is supported because when you're gripped by emotion, it just really does feel like something's happening to you and you feel rather more passive than when we're thinking coolly and deliberatively about something. So I think that subjective sense of difference maps to this somewhat useful distinction between thinking and feeling, and people stop there. And I think what these data and other work in this space are telling us is that we need more sophisticated models of how these are connected. And sometimes that means moving away from simple distinctions like thinking bucket and feeling bucket.
Thank you, James. That is really so insightful. And just listening to you, I am thinking that a lot of our listeners may be wondering, what can they do in their lives to improve their emotion regulation ability and to become better at reappraisal? So in other words, should people just wait for you or other emotion scientists to come and recruit them for another study that tests a reappraisal intervention? And I should say that if you and your co-authors keep going at this pace, recruiting 20,000 participants at a time, then maybe it's not actually such a bad idea to sit and patiently wait for your turn. But aside from that, is there something that people can do themselves to become better at reappraisal?
Well, so Kate, from my perspective, and I love the question, from my perspective, you know, this is really the core issue. So my experience is that, you know, as I said a moment ago, many people find emotions somewhat mysterious. We don't come with an instruction manual, most of us. And so we kind of fake it and, you know, learn what we can and try to develop insights by talking to other people. For some, therapy or coaching, you know, is a helpful adjunct. Some people are lucky enough to have parents or caregivers who are, you know, really helpful in terms of articulating an emotion perspective or philosophy. But a lot of us, you know, didn't get that. So we need to read and sort of think on our own. And I think from a practical perspective, the first step is just sort of paying more attention to one's emotions as we move through our lives, understanding emotions to be these loosely coupled changes in how we feel, how we respond behaviorally, and how our body responds. And this sort of loose coupling characterizes a pattern of responses that we have labels for, things like anger and sadness and anxiety, but those labels are imperfect. And so there's a little bit of slippage in what, let's say, I might consider anger and what you might consider anger for yourself. But we're doing our best in understanding our own emotions and those of people around us that we care about. And I think just attending to these emotion instances is a great start. Just noticing as we move through our lives, what are we feeling? When are we feeling it? What are the circumstances that give rise to these emotions? So noticing is, I think, a first step. The second step is, as you begin to notice emotions, you sometimes have the experience that sort of seeing that some of the emotions are really helpful. You're really glad that you felt happy for another person's success and communicated that to the other person. That's really made you feel closer to them and you've seen them more and you're feeling really good about that. Other times it doesn't work like that. You feel anxious or you get angry with someone and you snap and that kind of hurts your relationship. You don't know how to process it with the other person and just realize that that kind of response just kind of sets you and maybe your friend back. And by noticing emotions and distinguishing between times when emotions are kind of helpful using whatever metrics we want to apply versus when they're really pretty unhelpful allows us to have more choice because it sets us up to then ask an additional question, which is not just what am I feeling or is it helpful, but what can I do about it? And that's such a powerful question because I think if we think about emotions as occurring in situations that we pay attention to and that we think about in certain ways or appraise in certain ways, that gives us, I think, a very simple framework for thinking about the kinds of things we can do to influence which emotions we have. We don't have perfect control over our emotions, at least most people don't. But I do think if we have this idea that emotions can be at least partially controlled or regulated, and that we can do that by changing the situations that we're in or expose ourselves to, or we can change the way we attend to those situations, or we can change our emotions by changing the way we think about those situations that we've attended to, we already have a set of possible ways to regulate. So when we ask, gee, what can I do with an emotion that just doesn't seem to be working for me? I think we can think, well, are there things I can change about the situation or the way I'm paying attention or even the way I'm thinking about the other person or myself? And those questions about what strategies can I use and how can I use them lead people to experiment. So they might hear a discussion of reappraisal and then try to think differently about a partner who seems really grumpy. Instead of assuming that the partner is out to get me and hates me probably for some odd reason, this is just someone who's having a bad day. That shift in your thought perspective can really have a powerful impact. Instead of snapping at them in turn, you can actually be empathic and that can shift the dynamics powerfully. And I think as we notice our emotions, evaluate whether they're helpful, ask what we can do and try some things out, experiment a little bit, we can then see for ourselves what works for us and what doesn't. And that then I think enhances our sense, our belief that emotions are actually things we can modify a bit, both in ourselves and in other people. And I think that growing sense of confidence then allows us to more and more frequently track our emotions and modify them when we think that's going to be helpful. So that's sort of, I don't know, it's not a recipe, but those are the I think, steps that often are helpful for moving people from a sense of being overwhelmed and disrupted and set back by emotions to a greater sense of working with these powerful forces, shaping them at critical moments so that they're more effective in moving us towards things we care about and away from things we don't care about.
Thank you for this, another very thoughtful response. I'm sure our listeners will really appreciate it. And unfortunately, we're almost out of time, though I wish we could keep this going for a couple more hours. But thank you so much again for coming.
My pleasure, Kate. Thanks so much.